So my name is Lee Haffrey, and this session is titled Where East Meets West, A Place for Professional Ethics. Our agenda for the afternoon, I'd like to talk briefly about the concept for this session and explain where it comes from, and go around the room and have everyone introduce him or herself. At this point, it feels like I know about half the people in the room, which is great. I hope you'll get to know each other too. And then we'll go through a clip from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which many of you probably have seen at some point over the last 5 years, and a few passages from the Analects of Confucius, which are on the handout, which all of you should have in front of you. If anyone's missing a copy, there's a small stack at the back there. So we'll talk about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. We'll talk about Confucius. Then we're going to talk about Fred Zinnemann's film High Noon, a clip from that, and end with an article that someone said is must reading for anyone in business. That is business bluffing ethical? So that's the sequence. No explanation. Let me provide the explanation in one sec. We will run this as a standard Aspen seminar, which is to say that I'm here to ask questions, you're here to provide answers. And I will not make your lives miserable by calling on you if you're looking embarrassed, but I do hope that you will participate as the spirit moves you. Any questions before we start? Great. Okay. So the premise of this seminar is the following. It is really hard to get our hands around what it means to behave ethically and what ethics, singular, is. And so I moderated a panel this morning on business and responsible leadership with a set of distinguished panelists, and we talked about the question of the conscience of the corporation. We talked a lot, though, also about compliance. And I'm not sure that we got finally to a conclusion about the distinction that one might draw between compliance on the one hand and ethical behavior on the other. That is, what lies beyond obeying the strictures of Sarbanes-Oxley and other regulations that business people encounter on a regular basis. So I'm hoping that here today we can get at that difference and talk about what moves us, because this is, after all, the business and society track, what moves us beyond compliance, beyond the letter of the law, to the spirit of the law, and to ethical behavior as we define it more broadly in the society as a whole. That's the goal. And the piece that I'm looking at specifically in the juxtaposition of the Asian, specifically Chinese materials on the one hand and the American materials on the other is the degree to which we do, in fact, on a daily basis, merge personal values, that is, our personal sense of ethics, and what we do in the workplace, our professional commitments. And so for those of you who have read, and again, we have quotes in this handout from Albert Z. Carr's Is Business Bluffing Ethical?, a long-standing bestseller for the Harvard Business School publishing business, right? He says business is all about the rules of the game, and you should understand from the get-go that what you do in the workplace does not necessarily relate, and often does not relate, period, to what you do outside the workplace. And you need to understand that and play in business by the rules that obtain in that environment and recognize the difference. When we read Confucius, I think generally, at least in the West, we regard what we read in the Analects as a set of dictates on how to lead one's life. And what I'm hoping to do as we work through this material is to arrive at some recognition that there is, if nothing else, a flow back and forth between these two worlds, and then to draw some conclusions for us as a group about what that flow might mean for what we do both arenas. So that's the goal of the session. Let's go around the room, and maybe each of you could give us your name, where you're from, and why you're here in this room at this hour.
Now, fair. I'm Scopes. I'm from Denison, Colorado, and Chicago. And this is the first program I've taken in this track, so I'm not going to be
I don't think there's any continuity across this.
I was intrigued by this. I do a little reading, and I've also been intrigued by the different ways that business people in the East and the West approach things. That is of interest. After reading the thing that was sent out, I was kind of amazed that we're reading something from 1968 because I feel things have changed so much. And so I was
good. All right. Well, we'll hear how they've changed.
I'm Diane Ogilvie. I'm from Torrance, California. I work on the general counsel and a lot of other hats for Toyota Motor Sales in the United States and have responsibility for the communication itself. So I'm interested in
great. Okay. Kat, would you mind just giving these two gentlemen a copy of the handout? Thanks. Dave?
I'm David Bisno. I'm a retired ophthalmologist, and I've never been in business. For the past 14 years, I've been involved in lifelong learning with retirees in various parts of the world, and I'm here because I want to learn from Lee how to be an exemplary discussion leader. I've taken an Aspen Institute seminar with him before, and that's why I'm here to learn how to teach.
Thank you. Joe.
I'm Joe Goble. I'm a retired businessman, and I guess I'm somewhat dismayed in the overall attitude toward business. I think I find it unfortunate.
And you will go into greater detail about this?
I will go into
greater detail. My name is Adam Fish. I live here in Aspen, Colorado. Before that, I spent a lot of time in New York City where I was working, and I was involved in the currency markets, mostly in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. So I've, at some point or another, touched base with people in about 45 or 50 countries, I guess, so it's been interesting. I find dealing with people in Aspen harder than all that, but however, I've talked to a wide variety of people, so it's been interesting and to take some of that here. Now I'm just kind of in some lifelong learning, a lot of time at the Institute.
Great. Thank you, Adam.
My name is Pete Dickman. I teach ethics at Berkeley. Have done so for about 10 years, and during that time I have established a myriad of cases of why what the consequences of bad ethics are, but I have yet to figure out where that, you know, lodestone of why the ethical, the answer to that question. I haven't been able to explain it to my 60 students, all of whom are skeptical and waiting for that answer.
Thank you, Pete.
Good afternoon. I'm Sanjay Mukherjee from Management Center for Human Values, Indian Institute of Management, Calcutta, where I teach. Primarily around the areas of ethics and values and management. Spirituality in workplace, enlightened management, East-West Conference, business ethics, corporate social responsibility are the roughly the areas that I dabble with.
Terrific.
And I'm here as an Aspen Fellow for this time.
Thank you.
I'm Sidney Dickstein. Excuse me. I'm an attorney from Washington, D.C. I founded a law firm that now has about 400 lawyers. And I've dealt with CEOs and boards of directors and some accountants and other lawyers. And I've done some pondering about the very issues that are raised in this forum.
Okay, thank you, Sidney. Actually, could we just jump to the back and then we'll come back? Gentlemen?
Sure. My name is Andrea Mariani. I'm from Wharton College, and I'm working with the Institute right now. And after college, I plan on having my own business, and ethics is a very crucial part of business, so I'm hoping to be enlightened here.
Okay. Thank you.
My name is Enrique Lopez, and we go to St. College. We're interns here at the Aspen Institute, and I was just interested in this ethics because I took an environmental ethics course, so I just want some discussion here.
Great. Thank you.
My name is Jerry Okabe. I'm from Overland Park, Kansas. I work for Prism Business Media, responsible for audience marketing for our 70 magazine titles. And it was interesting to read this article from Harvard Business Review because it seemed to really apply to a lot of conflicts that I feel. So I think it'll be an interesting discussion.
Thank you.
I'm Barry Green. I work in Long Island, New York, for Hearst Business Media, which is a division of the whole Hearst Corporation. And I'm involved in audience development, circulation marketing for business publications and online web traffic. And we were, after lunch, talking about where to go, and Maurice had the article. And there's a lot of interesting information there that just makes you think about what happens every day as opposed to what's the, you know, the utopian or whatever, what it should be and what you face in the day-to-day work that you perform.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
I'm Maurice Persiani, and like Jerry and Barry, I'm in publishing as well, in audience development.
McGraw-Hill.
I work for McGraw-Hill. One of the things, we're good friends, but we also compete against each other. In fact, Barry and I are also serve on ABC Business Industry Committee, where we create the rules to be measured against. Uh-huh. And one of the things we were discussing before was that publishing is one of the most transparent businesses there is. You know the employees with their contact information. You know where our customers are with their contact information. And you can get our subscriber list by renting them to sell your products, which is very visible. There's no other business model out there like that. But why ethics is so important in publishing is that we are selling something that's relatively abstract, a page in a magazine to communicate a message and the effectiveness of it. So ethics touches everything that we do in our business.
Okay, I have to come back to that. So the exceptionalism of publishing, is that it? Okay. Kat?
My name is Kat Jaffe. I'm also an intern, and I'm currently at Wilson College, and I'm here for the summer. Why I am at the seminar is because Will swapped with me, A. And B, I'm moving to India in September, and I'm living there for a year, and I'm going to live in a monastery. And there are a lot of things that I'm looking to try and study while I'm there, but it completely intrigues me. And one of the things I've been studying is just the difference between how the East deals with things versus the West, and just this different mentality. Everything from business to ethics to women, religion, health, just so many different things. And I really want to study the lifestyle in any form of preparation, and just getting the exposure from you all, which has been great so far and an intimate level. So,
thank you.
I'm Paul Alston. I'm a lawyer from Honolulu, Hawaii. I represent a lot of Japanese companies and their dealings in Hawaii. And this seemed, frankly, to be the most interesting thing happening at 2:45 on
Saturday afternoon. Okay. Thank you, Paul.
I'm Melanie Sturm from Aspen, Colorado, and frankly, I'm taking this because you're moderating it. And I knew whatever you would moderate would be excellent.
Thank you, Mom.
But in addition, having gotten an MBA and worked in two different investment banks and then at the World Bank, I'm still kind of struggling with the issue of professional ethics. And most recently, currently, I'm embroiled in a legal matter that has a lot of ethical subject matter and implications.
Good. All right, we won't ask for details.
Yeah. I'm Joanne Hitt. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm a CPA, I think and hope an ethical one. I'm here because Melanie told me this would be great, but also because I am very disturbed by what I have seen in Enron and WorldCom and other examples.
All right. Actually, we should get Spike in here, too.
Sure, Spike. I'm here because I'm doing sound. I'm sure Lee has a lot of interesting things to say.
Thank you, Spike. David?
My name is David Unger. I'm the CEO of a small public manufacturing company. And I learned this morning, or it was confirmed to me, that I'm the conscience of the 1,000 people that work for me. It scares me very much. Okay. And it's just beginning to extend our global reach to plants around the world, and it's an exciting time for me, and it's important that I understand the impact of the kind of ethical behavior that we've been trained to exhibit and how we maintain our standards as we go out in the world. And also your wonderful moderator this morning, I'm happy to be here again.
Thank you.
I'm Mickey Younger, and I had gone to the session on China and India, what's in store, and I thought this would be a terrific tie-in for that, and I am concerned about our ethics here, and I know they're very different. In China, certainly, I had read China Inc., and it was an eye-opener.
Okay, sounds good. Catherine.
I'm Catherine Fleck. I live here in Aspen, Colorado, and I am here because I pushed my father downstairs, and so he couldn't make it. And, okay, wait a second, and for the same reason, Melanie is a great moderator.
But you didn't push your father down the stairs because you wanted to be in this particular session, right? Because
no,
then I'm going to start feeling guilty.
Sort of the general thing.
Okay.
They don't even have stairs.
Yeah, I'm lying.
that. You don't have to push anyone down the stairs. You can just, you know.
I'm Jeff Weisglass. I'm from Chicago. I've been here for 2 days, and this is the first time I sat in a room with people who actually introduced one another, and I just realized how much I'm craving, so thank you for having us do that. I grew up in a family with a family business, and then I went to law school, so I had a lot of interesting issues around ethics from those days. I left the private sector 18 years ago, and for the last 6 years I've been leading an organization working on money and values issues. We just closed that program, essentially folded that program into Naropa University in Boulder, which is a Buddhist-inspired university. So as I gave into an advisory over there, the point of these West issues was attractive to me in design. Move forward in my career, my interest is in addressing political polarization in Brazil and the United States. The whole question of East West and ethics and Brazil and all that.
Yeah, the bridge building piece is important, so that's good. Thanks for mentioning it. Jerry.
Jerry Pugh, Bloomington, Indiana. I'm here because I am interested in situations that I might be able to take back to my classes on leadership at Indiana University, and I've observed Lee in the past and hope to do something like that again this afternoon, unless he kicks me out.
I won't kick you out. You're welcome. Thank you. All right, so we'll try to bring, I mean, there are a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of different professional commitments in the room, concerns about ethics that I suspect vary widely across your individual experiences. So this is not going to be, we're not going to offer the silver bullet coming out of this, but I do hope that, that all of you can walk away from this session with a something to hang on to that gets you into conversations about ethics a little more easily. I'm sure that many of you have already had these conversations. My guess is you wouldn't be in this room if you hadn't. How many of you have seen Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon? Great. All right. Who wants to summarize the film for the rest of us? All right. So it has to be someone who's either seen it multiple times or seen it recently. Anyone? It's okay if you make a mistake. I'm just going to use the mistake. So any synopsis offered? What's it about, simply? I mean, forget about the metaphysics. You actually fell asleep in it? All right, well, we're going to try to wake you up on it this time. I am going to show a clip in about 1 minute, but it's, so what's the dynamic of this film? Let me tell you, just by way of introduction, I taught this film in China numerous times, actually, and I did it knowing when I went that the film, although it had been quite popular here, and it won the Academy Award, I think, for Best Foreign Film, right, and in 2001, was not at all popular in mainland China. And part of the reason I wanted to teach the film there was because I couldn't understand the cultural slippage, whatever it might be, that meant that people in China didn't find this film acceptable. And so I taught it in one case shortly after its release, six times in succession to six different audiences of Chinese IMB, so international MBAs, late 20s, early 30s. And each time I started the session by saying, all right, so explain to me why you didn't like this film, right? And so it was, well, the kung fu wasn't very good. And Michelle Yeoh had a funny accent when she spoke Mandarin because she's Malaysian Chinese and she didn't grow up speaking Mandarin. She had to learn her lines for the film. And then finally someone would say, well, you know, this film is really not a Chinese film. It's a Western film made for, it's a Western film about China made for Western audiences. And I'd say, yeah, well, the director is Ang Lee. All of the actors are Chinese, so what's the problem? How is this not a Chinese film? And, of course, the answer is, for the most part, the Chinese involved in the film, either behind the camera or on screen, are not mainland Chinese. And so what you've come down to, this was a cosmopolitan version of China today. And the mainland Chinese with whom I was discussing the film found that disconcerting. Now, this is the same group, however, that argued, I think, pretty consistently that they as international MBAs were merging with a global market, and that they needed to find out how the West did business if they were going to survive in the global marketplace. So at that level, they did want to become cosmopolitan. But they didn't want to have their cultural integrity spoiled by the kind of, you know, having a film that was directed by someone who was Taiwan born and bred and American trained. And so the culture, to your question about a bridge building, the cultural dimensions of this film were problematic for my Chinese students. So, but the film, briefly, I will go where no other person in this room was willing to go. At least theoretically, it's about this sword, the Green Destiny, right? That Li Mu Bai, the head warrior in the film, has and wants to give up because he has had enough of the warrior life. And the sword migrates among various players throughout the film. Someone steals it, someone tries to get it back, et cetera, et cetera. The nicer points of this film, and they are fundamentally the heart of the film, come out not in the sword itself, which is the easy thing to latch onto, but in the relationships among the various players in this film. So what I'd like to do now is have Spike run a clip for us. It's about 6 minutes, and that, I think, will take us to the heart of the film, and its overall significance for us as well as for the Chinese IMBAs, as they all recognized once we'd had the conversation that followed on the why didn't you like this film? Because by the time we were done with an hour and a half session, they were in a very different place, as well they should have been. All right, go ahead, Spike. Kat, could you turn off the lights?
Just looking for a room to then finally not be a nuisance.
Ah, I am head servant to know, and this is another of our guests.
I must say, it's heavy for such a thin piece of metal.
It is all in the hilt, and the blade is no ordinary metal. Still, the sword, as weapons go, is wonderfully light. The problem is always getting used to handling them.
It's not a problem for me alone. When I was little, the Western residents had a garrison of Imperials. They would let me play guard every day. This cavern is so beautiful.
And so is the sword, except when it is tainted with blood. Imagine, this work is 400 years old.
Exquisite. Sorry, you said it belongs to
a friend of mine, the warrior Li Mu Bai. He has decided to give it to Belaye.
Li Mu Bai? The greatest of all the warriors? To Belaye? I wouldn't give up something like that in a million years.
It is a long story about swords.
You sound like a real expert.
Oh yes, but I prefer the Shuang Dao to a normal blade. I am not much good with a straight sword. For certain moves, however, you really need this.
But I guess it's wonderful being a warrior, to be totally free.
Even our Jung-Hu world has a certain code. Integrity, trust, friendship. Without rules, none of us would survive very long.
I've read all about the great fighters like you, roaming wild, dispensing with those who get in your way.
If they told how it really is, they wouldn't sell many books.
You're just like in the stories.
Oh, no place to bathe for days. Sleeping on the ground or in flea-infested beds. Is all that in the tales?
In 2 weeks, I'm married. Only it's really not the type of life that I want.
But it is a good arrangement, so I hear. Congratulations. To get married is a joyous event.
You're not married, by chance.
Think I am?
No. You couldn't roam around so freely.
You are an opponent I better not argue with.
such as 3 inches long, 1 1/10 inches wide. The head is 8 inches long, 2.6 inches wide, and 7/10 of an inch thick, with 7 rubies missing from the guard. The design tells you that it was made before the Qin dynasty and engraved with a technique that, by the time the Han started to rule, was long lost.
Belle, they should appoint you court historian.
A sword by itself doesn't rule. A sword lives through skillful handling.
Please continue. You have an avid listener.
The imperial court isn't our concern. With officials and royalty, on every street corner, you can be sure the Royal Guard keeps security tight. But Beijing is not a wilderness like the Western provinces. This is a world full of wild characters. Your quest to run a healthy city depends not on the judges and their courts. It's by courting the warriors of Jianghu that your position will always be safe. To be strong and supple, the secret to ride out the storm.
All right, Kat, could you turn the lights back on, please? All right, so let's unpack this. What did we just see? And what does it tell us about, well, obviously about the film, but even more about the world that the film is evoking? And I don't think we need to dwell here on East-West differences, on, you know, whether this is an American scene or a Chinese scene. Just what do you see here? And you've all seen the film, so you know, now this will refresh your memory, you know what's going on in the background. Sydney?
Yes, I have a thought. I'm not sure whether it's going in a direction, but when you speaks of rules and then expands friendship, trust, integrity,
right?
It strikes me as having a very different sense than one would normally apply to the word rules. The piece that you distributed for reading before the workshop in the Harvard Business Review, in which is my takeaway from that article was, you have to play the game according to the rules of the game. But their two rules had a different meaning than it seemed to have in this dialogue.
Okay.
And I looked at the copyright date, and it struck me that rules back in 1967 have a very different meaning than rules of business conduct would have today.
All right. Do you want to explain to us what that difference would be, just so that we have it on the table?
What the difference is?
Yeah, between 67 and, because one, someone else said that earlier, right? You know, but I think it was you, Sue.
The rules in 67 time frame, I think, were more discernible, were clearer, provided better guidelines, as poker an analog, that everybody knows the rules of the game include bluffing, and that's okay in business as well as in poker. But the rules, clever people have learned how to take the rules and distort them, if you would, or interpret them. Even a nice word. And the rules to me are by no means quite so clear. Maybe they weren't in 67, but my perception is that they were clearer in 67.
These three, friendship, trust, integrity, which set of rules is this? Is this the rules of 67 or the rules of 2006?
I wouldn't characterize them the rules of either 67 or 2006. I characterize them as ethical elements.
Okay.
And not rules as would normally be understood.
Okay, so ethics, we say, not rules of the game, right?
Right.
Okay, anyone else? Sue, do you want to add to this?
No, the funny thing was that when I only read it once, I kind of thought the 67 article raised all the questions I would have today. And I guess I was kind of amazed that I hadn't changed or learned more or whatever. I thought this was kind of a timeless
current
approach.
Okay.
But as I said, I didn't read it more than once, but maybe.
Okay, now do you see similarities between these rules and what Yu Shulian is talking about here in this scene that we just saw?
Well, yeah, I think friendship, trust, and integrity has been a part of what a businessman, a woman, would have wanted to be known for in any of these.
So it is effectively a code?
Well, maybe I mean to old fashioned.
Okay, so it's, we're going to say it's...
Am I going to be dealt with one side of the room?
No, there are no dunces caps in this room, so it's a code, right? Sue says, and I think we'll come back to you, Sydney, on this, but so we've got the articulation of a code here, right? Friendship, trust, integrity. Why is this even an issue in the scene that we just saw, so between the two women? Jen is the young girl... Who's also the daughter of the governor, whom we see in the following scene with the two men, right? And Yu Shulian, who's the older woman, played by Michelle Yeoh. Why is it even a topic of discussion?
David? Well, in both cases, the elder is passing on rules and points of behavior, what to expect to the younger person. You know, part of what we all do in life.
Right, so there's a kind of mentoring as well.
Or passing the torch or mentoring, or this is what it's going to be like. And if you know the rules, you've got a better opportunity to be successful at whatever game it is you're playing.
And Jen, so the younger woman, sees the world how?
Well, she's an innocent, but she's not as much as innocent as she wants you to think.
Right.
She's had some life experience that the older woman doesn't know about yet.
Yeah.
She'll learn.
So, but her ideal world is what kind of a world? Jen, so the younger woman, what?
She's afraid she has to do what her father wants her to do.
Right, so she's going to have to get married.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I take it as strength is best. I mean, she's saying, roaming wild, beating up anyone who gets in the way. That's more of a...
So.
Anarchy sort of approach.
Well, anarchy or...
Or freedom.
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 Might is right. Okay. Then, but you could say the cardinal virtue is freedom. But she interprets freedom as freedom to abuse anyone who gets, or to get rid of anyone who stands in the way of your freedom. Right?
Her father seems to be standing in her way.
Her father seems because he's asking her to get married.
Sure.
Telling her to get married.
To somebody he selected.
Yeah. Barry.
Yeah, the difficult thing I find, having seen, you know, we've all seen the movie, is getting back to that we know in conversations at times, I think we're all saying something, and especially in business, and I'm saying if I could only read the back of the mind of the person who's talking, because we know that everybody, quote, has a hidden agenda. And in their cases here, everybody's got a backstory that is not exactly what they're saying out loud.
Right.
And it's difficult just to take them at I can't take them at the word of what they're saying on screen now, knowing, you know, the other side of the coin. And, you know, I was trying to put myself in a position of trying to forget it and look at Qi Yang. Zhang Yi, whichever way she does it now, you know, and just look at her as an innocent at that point.
But whether you know the backstory or not, the dynamic between the two women is the one that I think that David captured. That is, Shulian is saying, look, there are rules, you know, friendship, trust, integrity. These apply, and the younger woman is saying, yeah, you actually, you know, It must be great. You get to do whatever you want, wherever you want, whenever you want, and I'm going to have to get married. And you, by the way, are not married. Isn't that wonderful? And Julien says, what does she say?
Marriage is good.
It's part of the deal, right? Specifically for you, young lady, right? Because what's the class difference here? And this is actually quite important. So we know that you, that is Shuyan, is she is a warrior, right? She's a warrior, and Jen is what? An aristocrat, right? So they actually belong to two different parts of the society. And when Shuyan says to Jen, marriage is part of the package, she's saying, for you, the aristocrat, this is the way it goes. Arranged marriages and, you know, a sedentary life. Forget about roaming the desert. Forget about your lover out in, you know, out in the plains. Get straight. Put on the gown and get wed, right? And for me, and Jen says, yeah, look at the deal you've got. You know, whatever you want. And Julien says, no, it's not quite like that. All right, so that's one half of the picture. The other half is, at least is for what we saw, Governor Yu and the man who is referred to in the subtitles and the conversation is Sir Tay. Who are they, and what are they having a conversation about? So this is the two guys. Power struggle between. Is it a power struggle? Anyone?
I think it's how to rule.
Yeah, how to rule.
Yeah.
So the topic of conversation here is how to rule. And it's interesting that you should have used the same word. So Sidney brought up the question of rules, and indeed in the conversation between Julien and Jen, it's about rules. And here it's about ruling, right? All right, so what's the lesson? Now, let's do the class thing again, just so we have it on paper. So Governor Yu is an aristocrat, right? Well, he's an aristocrat. And he has come, it would seem, to be essentially the mayor of Beijing, right? And Sir Tay, he's a wise one. I think he's also an aristocrat, or to use a different term. I mean, he's in a slightly different place. He clearly has been around in Beijing for a while. He's not coming. He's not being flown in from the western, the wastes of the west to govern. He's already on location. And what does he know about life in Beijing that Governor Yu apparently does not?
Better have some connections in the underworld security.
Yeah, position. He better have some connection. Yeah. So it's about the underworld, and it's linked to what? No. So what else is there in this society besides the underworld that he refers to?
The bureaucracy, the court.
Yeah, the court. Right. So you've got the world in Beijing is made up of, at least for power purposes, the underworld and the court. And the phrase in the film that both Sir Tay and in this scene with the two women, Julien uses is Jiang Hu. So that's the underworld or the world of the warrior. And so the lesson in ruling, to use Pete's phrase, is you want to run this town, you're going to have to realize that having the court on your side is not enough to make it happen. You need the warriors. And the warriors include specifically Shulian, but also Li Mubai, whose sword is the center of all of this discussion. Right? So you've got two different, it's actually the way the world looks. And part of the reason I came to the sort of the physical formulation I did, this is, so I'm just going to say the world of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is one in which you have the court and you have Jiang Hu. And they are mutually dependent for purposes of ruling and codifying the rules. But there is a real difference. This is, it is hierarchical, right? This is also, of course, the world of the emperor, right? And it's about status. And it's about the law. Whereas the world of Jiang Hu is pluralist. That is, you've got a lot of different schools of martial arts skills. So it's pluralist. It's meritocratic. Because the better you are at your martial art, the more capable you are of dominating in a world that is fundamentally, this is stable. And this is violent. So there are two. The world of the warrior is always in flux. But it does depend on merit in a way that this does not. And it's precisely, and this is something, you know, so I said that I taught this film six times in succession. Six times in succession, the students who were watching this film said, this is the way the world looks. You've got the world of the emperor and you've got the world of the warrior, and the two are mutually dependent, and you cannot sever the link between them. But the possibility of ethics exists right along this fault line here. That is, when you know what the system is, when you know the way the system works, and at the same time you want the freedom that a couple of people referred to earlier, it's the tension in this environment that allows you to be finally ethical. So it's not just about law, it's about your own aspirations, your own goals, your own skills, the rules that we, I think, all like to believe are, in fact, transcendentally human. So about friendship, about integrity, about trust. So I got the same diagnosis six times. Sorry, my spelling's a little bit weak here. Six times in succession, the same image of the world. And then, of course, at the end of the discussion, one or another of the students would say, it's actually the same thing, you know, Robin Hood. What do you think Robin Hood was about? What about American Westerns? Which is why I wanted to bring in High Noon. Because when you think about it, it's exactly the same kind. And the scene that we're going to look at shortly from High Noon will, I think, substantiate it. That there is this bipartite scenario for where people fit into the society that determines where we, in fact, wind up exercising our ethical responsibilities. We're going to come back to this in greater detail in a few minutes. But this is sort of the outline, the physical outline for ethics as a possibility that I wanted to put before you. And I wouldn't have come up with this on my own. It was the students who generated it for me, and they clearly recognized it as a reality. And I had faculty sit in on one of the sessions, and he said, you know, the real problem for the CCP, so the Chinese Communist Party, which currently sits up here, is that their claim to legitimacy is they come from down here. And they are constantly wrestling with the fact that they have wound up here instead of staying with the people and with the freedom and the sort of natural rules that would allow them to govern legitimately. So the real life implication, current real life implication of the schema is, I think, significant. All right, so that's the backdrop and the film. Let's talk a little bit about Confucius, and we come right back to what we just left here with our discussion of the conversation between Governor Yu and Beileye, or Sirte, the first of the Analects. So this is the second section of the handout. 1.5, the master said, to governor state of middle size, one must dispatch business with dignity and good faith, be thrifty and love all men, mobilize the people only at the right times. So for those of you who are business people, does this sound right to you? And indeed, the word business comes up in the translation, though not necessarily in the original. If you're running an organization, is this the formula?
Except
the love all men part? Why would you exclude that?
I disagree. I mean, what do you think? Love all men, I translate that to relationships. In order to be successful, you have to have sustainable relationships. So that's how I translated that.
All right, so you think that works. Okay. Anyone else on this? David, you said you run a small organization. Let's say for the sake of argument, you're really running a middle-sized organization.
Well, in the scheme of things. But you run it through people. You can't. I try to relate to people at all levels in my company, but there's. I don't only give instructions at the direct report level. And I court those people. Loving them is important to me and to them.
What does loving them mean? I mean, since we've already had hesitation about this, when you use that phrase, what do you mean?
Care for them, know about their personal lives, help them when you can, support them when they need support to do the disagreeable things that maybe they have to do from time to time, and let them know you appreciate their efforts.
Okay. Anyone else on this? Yeah.
The statement of dignity and good faith would be a matter of values.
Yeah.
Thrifty would be a matter of personal character. And love for all men would be the emotive enrichment, the emotive bonding in the organization. That's how I see it.
And is this a complete formula as you see it, as you translate it?
I would use the word formula, but both are all are important.
Okay. Right. So this, but this adds up to a recipe for sound management. Does it?
These are very really important parts.
Yeah, Sydney.
On love all men. If that is understood as meaning love all men, notwithstanding their transgressions, I don't think that's a good rule for leadership or organizing a middle-sized government or a middle-sized business enterprise. I think one must be discerning. David Greenberg this morning made the point that one of the ways in which they maintain an ethical corporation is by dealing severely, I would say,
right,
with those who transgress.
Right. So if you went to David Greenberg and you said, all right, so we've got this formula in Confucius about loving all men, I take it that you do not love the vice president whom you have excised from the corporation because he or she committed fraud of some kind, right? What would he say to you?
He may say, well, I regret what I had to do, but it had to be done.
For what reason?
For the sake of the enterprise.
Okay, not for the sake of the individual?
No.
Okay.
It all depends on the manifestation of love. Love is a very deeper construct. Sometimes, when it's a translation, the manifestation will be very violent. But love is there, the peace. Well-being of the individual and the organization. In this case, because it's a translation, its manifestation will be very punishing. But deep within, there is a sense of well-being. On the other hand, if there is a positive note, then love comes out as we usually see, positive flow. But it could be a negative flow with love within because of this context is different.
Well, is either the positive or the negative flow a possibility? Are they both possibilities in a corporate environment?
Both are possible.
They are possible. Okay. All right, so let's keep that in the background. Let's go to the next one. So 1610. Yeah, Joe.
The mobilize the people only at the right times.
Right.
I've got difficulty with that.
Okay, because you read it as saying what?
I'm not even sure how it fits in the context of the rest of the sentence. Mobilize the people only at the right time. Where I put the emphasis on only, I'm not sure what he's trying to say.
Anyone else?
It bothered me. It's in today's fast-paced economy, you need the people moving all the time.
Paul, you had your hand up.
What I understood that to mean was, don't stir people up unnecessarily. When you need them, call on them, but don't impose on them unnecessarily.
And how in the current environment, how would imposing on them unnecessarily manifest itself?
Insisting, for example, that they work on tasks that aren't necessary, or work on schedules that are, harmful to their family lives, when instead of saying, look, you've got a family, I understand that, you've got to take care of your family, and I will ask you to work 7 days a week only when we really need you. We're not going to insist that you do it just because if I make you work 7 days a week, I don't have to hire as many people. It's being fair to them in their lives.
Does that work
for you? No, I agree with that.
Okay, Joe, are you still on?
Okay.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple things missing from this. I mean, because, yes, I believe these are all ingredients, but I think you need a vision and a purpose, and you need to communicate it to people. And I think when you communicate, you don't necessarily mobilize them, and they will know when it's need to be mobilized. So people have to be responsible for themselves as well and responsible to the organization, but it's got to be communicated. And I don't see where they are talking about the vision or the purpose of what they're doing.
First of all, this is a Confucius thing. This is not it's not written by Peter Drucker. So I think we have to take a lot out of it that's built in there. I would take all that stuff is built in there. When they say mobilize, I want people at the right time. I agree, it's more of a hands-off management to let them do that and let them figure out their own vision so they can grow as well. And you mobilize the right time is when you might see them going off on a different path, or if they're not making a sales quota, or whatever else you want to look at it. But I think to sum up how to run a business in 20 words, it's a pretty good synopsis to follow.
How do you answer the direct question about communicating your intent? Do you find that has been answered here, even in 20 words? Or is there some suggestion in these 20 words that it is?
When I read mobilize people only at the right time, I assume that, listen, you know what you need to go do. If you're doing something I don't think you need to do and I'm the boss, that's the right time. And mobilizing is the communication part to me.
Okay.
Yeah. I think dispatching business with dignity and good faith is part of
fills
the
community. Fills that. Yeah. Okay. I guess I would agree. Let's go to the next analect, though, because that may help answer your concern. So Confucius said, a gentleman takes care in 9 circumstances. When looking to see clearly, when listening to hear distinctly, in his expression to be amiable, in his attitude to be deferential, in his speech to be loyal, when on duty to be respectful, when in doubt to question, when angry to ponder the consequences, when gaining an advantage to consider if it is fair. So it's Maurice, right? So does this telegraph, if you were as the CEO of an organization, whether it's McGraw-Hill or some other, if you were behaving in this fashion, would you feel that you were sending a signal about what you thought appropriate behavior in your organization would be?
Sorry.
Anyone else on this? Now, where is the line here? And I know that there are some of you who have read, is business bluffing ethical? But hold that in abeyance for a moment, and let me ask you, is this behavior as it lies on the page here the kind of thing you would do in an organization? Or is it something that you practice at home among friends, family?
Most definitely you do in an organization.
You do?
Definitely.
Okay, explain how you can get away with being deferential in a 21st century American corporation,
David. I think you can. You defer to the skills and the wisdom of your colleagues. And one of the ways that you gain their respect and their ability to follow you is to appreciate the good things they bring to the table. And build that confidence. I think that's really important. You don't boss people around anymore. You move them.
This describes a very consensus-driven organization.
So this would be some organizations, not necessarily all organizations. It could.
Some organizations are still very hierarchical. This is not a hierarchical.
Okay, Adam.
In the West, it might not be hierarchical, but in the East, it could be very well hierarchical. You don't hear the words ponder and deferential in my view of Western capital. But in the East, this is, in Asia, in places like this, this could be a lot more applicable to a pyramid type of structure. Not many people ponder consequences before speaking, including me. So, I mean, it's definitely a Western, in my Western mind and Western eyes, it's a wonderful way to live life as well as run a business. But it's not done nearly as much here as I think it would be on the Ten Commandments of the East.
Okay. Yeah, Melanie.
having attended business school, I think often people are using their IQs
and developing their IQs with respect to business and not really utilizing the emotional IQ, which is sometimes talked about. To me, this is very much about the emotional IQ. This is about, I don't think it's East or West. I think it's, and having worked in investment banking as the low one on the totem pole, I was very deferential. And when I got angry, I pondered the consequences. And so I do think it's applicable, but I just think it's only if you're thinking in the sense of you know, how to get along, how to advance a goal, how to be cooperative. Maybe it's just the difference between men and women.
Barry? Barry and then Jerry.
Okay, I think the sentiments are beautiful. What I was trying to do here was to sit and think about my boss and say, what of these things do I see that he doesn't do and what he does do? And, you know, if he could follow some of the other, maybe two or three of these points added into what he does well, I think our organization would run much better. The two things, though, that I find just in general to me, let's say, is it's very difficult in a business at times to, when you doubt, to question. Sometimes people don't want to hear it because they're looking at the overall agenda and not at the minutia. And I think a lot of what we do is try to bring, they don't like that there's not a simple answer. You can't just say you do A and B will happen and there's no such thing. So that's difficult. But I love the last comment, when gaining an advantage to consider if it is fair. That's I just love that line.
Because?
It's
so hard to do.
It's impossible. Yeah, I mean, it's almost impossible to do.
Yeah, we do that in the ABC Industry Committee all the time. But in business, you know, like in an article that said, hey, somebody always has to win. So be a winner, right?
You did. Yeah, whether you're being fair or not?
No, I mean... Well, no, I think in gaining an advantage, in business you're always trying to gain an advantage. Always. I mean, when you're creating the product, you know, what's the benefit of that? How's it compared to your competitors? You're looking for that advantage in everything. I would never say, if I have an unfair advantage over you, that's great. You know, I don't want competitors.
Okay. So we had a couple, do you still want to go?
I was just thinking, this to me kind of makes for a very well-rounded individual. And the two thoughts that I had were one, introspective, what are these things do I do that I feel that I do well, and what things am I not doing quite so well? But then I was thinking of the people that I work with and thinking about the various things that are exhibited in those people. It's interesting to think about that because you see this. I mean, you deal with people every day that either do or don't do some of these things well.
So this is a recipe for completeness.
I think if we could all do all of these things well, that it would make for a much better environment.
But do you believe that the organization, as organization, gets in the way of our being this complete?
Well,
or is it about individual failure?
Maybe not the organization, but individually.
Okay.
How we respond to these.
You were nodding. So.
Okay. I've never been CEO of a big company. But, for instance, take Southwest Airlines. That many of us have enjoyed lower fares and some of the other things. They've done this thus last year because somehow they jumped into the oil market, or, you know, the fuel market, and made a big buy. Now, in this... That was an advantage. They said, if we'll give you this many gallons and this many...
You being competitors to Southwest?
I mean, I don't know how... I might not be on the right track in this one.
No, you're absolutely right.
I would like this article because it made you think of exact instances. And like the Southwest instance, which might not be the best thing. But I think we're in a never-never land on these things. And I... This is kind of really surprising coming out of the mouth. But what happened to the idea that you're hired and I'm giving you money to do a job, and that in a way is very important, and that you owe me something for, you are an employee. I don't know how to say that, but this sounds too nicey-nice to me, and from what my experience in the business world.
Okay.
So I'm now really in the corner, right?
All right. No. Sydney, you've had your hand up several times in the past 3 minutes, so go ahead.
I don't think it's too nicey-nicey at all. My big takeaway from this morning's session was a regret that every leader of every corporation cannot be a Sydney Harmon. And
For those of you who weren't there, Sydney Harmon is the founder and chief executive of Harmon International Industries, which does so Harmon Kardon, it's audio. Yeah.
And when he spoke this morning about what he does in his own company, that was my feeling. But as I read this, it sounds to me like his mother was trained in Confucian philosophy, because I would bet that he would agree with every one of these propositions and not think that it is in any respect a hindrance, to the contrary, an advantage in running a large corporation.
All right, just to put the across the T on this piece of our discussion, and then we'll move on to, I think, is business bluffing ethical, because it's clearly on a lot of people's minds. Let's read this, the last of the Analects on the second page, so the top of the second page. Zhejiang asked Confucius about humanity. The master said, whoever could spread the five practices everywhere in the world would implement humanity. And what are these? Courtesy, tolerance, good faith, diligence, generosity. Courtesy wards off insults. Tolerance wins all hearts. Good faith inspires the trust of others. Diligence ensures success. Generosity confers authority upon others. Again, is this too nicey-nice to use so Adam, yeah.
When it comes to business, usually people win by intelligence or a new product or something like that. And the people that go from here to here are able not only to have a great product, but they have this. This doesn't interfere with any type of innovation, any type of thought process, any type of intelligence. If you have an advantage because you come up with a widget, you should be able to make as much money. If you invent the new, better widget because you stole it from your competitor, that is unfair, and that's the problem. So I think you can still be a ruthless competitor.
And practice
all these, because these are it was on another page, I think, just kind of, they're not rules, they are just kind of a code of conduct on how to behave, but it doesn't stop you from really succeeding in business or in life or something like that, which is usually better ideas, better innovation, quicker to the market than it ended up.
Okay.
I have a few points, very quickly. One is this distinction between the East and the West.
Yeah.
That we sometimes make probably doesn't hold good right now today in the world, in that black and white terms. Like the East that is portrayed here is also not an Indian East. The Indian East is very different. It's a combination of West and this.
Right.
One of the wisdom literatures of India is set in the battlefield. It's called the Gita, which Stafford Beer calls the greatest book on decision making. Which is you're about to fight, and fight your enemies who are your near and dear ones. Before that, what's the mindset which is required? So the shades of the East and the shades of the West are really important to consider at this point. One. And as far as the wisdom of this is required, I personally see there's a logic of the sequencing. You see, the first two things, seeing and listening, are most important before you come to the next seven. All your ideas of visioning and, you know, communication and whatever you talk about, leadership, start from the first two to be able to see properly as it is and listen without the noise.
Okay. So, and then we have the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of the last of the Analects. Okay. So, you didn't like the word formula the first time I used it, but as a prescription for effective business, you're saying, why not?
Yes, of course.
East or west?
These are pillars.
Okay.
Formula X, the problems.
All right. So now let's get to the nagging issue here. And that is, for those of you who have read Is Business Bluffing Ethical? And for those of you who haven't, there are three paragraphs here that I think summarize the article. But for those of you who have already got a head start here, how does anything that we've just discussed with Confucius square with what our friend Albert Z. Carr tells us about bluffing and its use in business? Put it together. Yeah, Melanie.
Well, in the third to the last paragraph, he says, to be a winner, a man must play to win. This does not mean that he must be ruthless, cruel, harsh, or treacherous. On the contrary, the better his reputation for integrity, honesty, and decency, the better his chances of victory will be in the long run. And I guess I've been struggling with this notion because so much of today's business world is predicated on success in the short run. And the perverse incentives that are, the exogenous forces that act on people who are trying to adhere to these standards. And then their behavior gets distorted because in the short run they can't live out this standard because they have short-term necessities, and it distorts their behavior, and they resort to borderline ethics or unethical behavior, like investment banks that want to go win investment banking business and encourage their research analysts, or the research analysts know they'll get paid if they win the business, and that distorts their view that they're reflecting in their research. That kind of short-termness, or the CEO that has the requirement to quarterly report earnings and talk about the prospects for a company, which with all the variables in our economy and world, it's very difficult to manage things on such a short-term upward trajectory. So unless you're willing to suffer the consequences of an up-and-down stock price, you're going to have to fudge things a bit.
All right. And so do you have an antidote for this? Do you see cars providing an antidote for it?
Well, I think that one of his thoughts is put yourself in a strong position where you're not going to be subject to the forces that would otherwise make you do something that you don't see as ethical, like the guy who wants to win the business of the person who's supporting the political candidate, so he writes the check. If he weren't so concerned about losing that guy's business, in other words, if he were stronger, then he wouldn't feel like he had to compromise his own value. So be strong. And also, I think this point about thinking more in the long run, and what's your reputation? What's your how are you perceived in terms of how you conduct your business is so much more important in the long term than some short-term gains you might realize. So I think it's twofold. Thinking more long-term and the long-term consequences of short-term opportunism.
Okay. And actually, Jonathan Oppenheimer, who just walked in this morning, talked this morning about the importance of time in shaping ethical behavior in an organization. Because if you think about the long-term commitment of a company to its community, to the environment in which it works, you are likely to behave in a manner that most of us, I think, would regard as more ethical rather than what the short term might dictate. So I think you're on the same wavelength. Yeah, Jeff.
I just want to say something else about time.
Yep.
Just as you said that, I was thinking about the importance of the time to reflect on decisions and how much the time pressures, and you talked about the fast pace of the work world earlier. You don't have the time or take the time or have the culture to say we ought to be even reflecting on these questions in the process of day-to-day decision-making. And so both time frame for decisions, but just the way time is managed on a day-to-day,
okay,
hour-to-hour, minute-to-minute basis.
So it would be, in the long run, is one cure for Melanie's short-termism, but also time routinely, right? So making the time on a daily basis, to think about what you said.
Systemically, in some way, you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, Jonathan, now that I've invoked you, so.
I'm sorry, but I think you just hit on a wonderfully interesting thing. Can I ask an interesting question? How many people here actually think that the information that they read and they spend so much time in the day reading is relevant to the decisions they're making? So I'm going to keep my hand firmly down because I don't most of the time. As corporate leaders, how many decisions do you make a year?
Say that again.
As corporate leaders or community leaders, how many decisions do you make a year? Many? Few.
Many.
I ran a business in South Africa. I stepped aside. Great guy took over in February. In 18 months, we re-engineered the business. We retrenched about 25% of our employees. We turned an organization of 10,000 people, where 7,000 were working in loss-making operations, to an organization of 7,500 people, of which everybody was working in profitable organizations. Added 50% of the bottom line of the business, I took one decision. That was to start the process to re-engineer the business. The rest weren't mine. I encouraged people, I cajoled people, I talked to people, I uplifted people, I enabled people, I empowered people, but that was the only decision that I took.
Everything else was a reaction?
Yeah. And my point is, if you're going to actually be a leader, you need to take strategic decisions, not action-oriented decisions.
Well, this actually, because you walked in late, but this fits in, I would think, with the problem phrase that we discussed earlier, that is, mobilize the people only at the right times, which includes mobilizing yourself only at the right times.
And in that context, when you read information, is this information informing a decision that you must take or somebody else to take? And if it's somebody else's decision, why are you reading that information? And that creates a lot of time in your life.
Yeah, Paul, are you going to bring us...
I think you're using a false definition of decisions, because every time you empowered somebody, you made a decision. Every time you encouraged somebody, you made a decision. Those are all critically important decisions.
That's in your DNA, though. Right. That you're reacting. Put your DNA, and that's a reaction decision.
No, but those are all strategic decisions. I mean, you're deciding... This person's on the right course. That person's an idiot.
Right. Has on a decision to be authorized.
Those are all decisions that you make.
Okay, then I made every decision. On that definition, in terms of a conscious decision, pressing a button to cause action,
yes.
I did one.
Okay.
I was happy with the team around me, and I supported them in the process. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. But you didn't just go home and take a vacation.
No, absolutely not. But I caveated that. I encouraged them. I engaged with them. I uplifted them. I empowered them. Consulted with them, I gave them support when they took difficult decisions. I wasn't the action agent.
But in the course of that, you were probably nudging people a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right.
But I don't see that as decision making.
Okay, so are we still with Karen bluffing? Because what I heard coming into the session was, that's really the way it is in business, okay?
I agree it's the way it is in business. But I think one of the most important things, you have time. I think time is the wrong word. I think sustainability. Because to have a successful business, it has to be sustainable. And it's only going to be sustainable if you have excellent relationships with your customers. You have to have people coming back. You have a limited universe.
Excuse me?
About to supply. Oh, that as well. It's all about relationships. Relationships with your employees, relationships with your customers, relationships with your investors. To be successful, you have to have sustainable relationships throughout.
And what does that tell us about bluffing?
Use it carefully.
Use it carefully because...
you lose credibility.
Never show your cards after you've bluffed.
Why do you bluff? Why do you bluff, according to Carr?
Bluff is more of a challenge to me.
Because everyone's doing it.
Well, it's almost you avoid a current sticky situation. It's almost thinking in the now as opposed to thinking in the future. As I think this is very important. That what do you want to do? Do you want to just solve this problem, or do you want to do something that may be bad for the moment, like, I guess, Audi, when the cars used to just go into the garage and hit the garage wall,
yeah.
and, you know, take the problem and solve it in the long term, which is better for the organization.
All right, so in fact, bluffing is a strategy that you tie to short-term thinking, which is where Melanie had us 5 minutes ago, right? So if you're thinking long-term, which is where Jonathan and I wanted to take us and a couple of other people have too, then bluffing probably isn't the ideal technique, because it is nice to translate bluff as challenge, but how else might you translate it?
Lying.
Yeah, lying, right? Does Carr allow for that translation of the term bluffing? I mean, does he recognize that that's what's going on? Okay. So is this a world we want to live in? Or how do we turn this? Because what he's saying is, and my guess would be that those of you who initially at least said, this is the way the world works, you know, whether it's lying or not, it is about the business as a game in which there's a set of rules that anyone who wants to play knows the rules and will play by those rules, even including, because someone else said, I think maybe it was you, Melanie, everyone else is doing it, right? So if bluffing is part of the rules of the game for business, you will do it too.
Can I actually put forth another definition, though? That it's a form of communication where you get to understand what the other side is thinking, and the give and take of that process yields the ultimate middle ground answer. So it's like you're not going to put your house on the market for the price that you expect to get. You're putting it at a higher price, and the person who offers is lowballing it, and you expect to meet somewhere in the middle. To me, that's not lying. That's just part of the communication process in business.
It's plain.
And it's expected.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I expect you to ask for more than you want for the house, or believe you can fairly get for the house, and I will make you an offer that I consciously know to be too low given the value of the house.
But you don't know, it's not always just the value of the house, it's the other circumstances that the person selling it might have. Maybe they need to sell, and you kind of want to know. Gee, maybe I can strike a lower price here than the fair value because they need to get out fast. You know,
okay.
It's just a way of communicating without asking pointedly the question.
Yes, it does sound like negotiation, absolutely. And I don't think you're arguing differently, right? Yeah, Dave.
Well, just talk about the factory in the UAE. And we're selling a product for use in that marketplace, in the whole Gulf Cooperation Council area. And the pace of the character of the negotiations is much more prolonged there than it seems to be in the U.S. We have a product to sell. We make a price. They offer us another price. We're going through this like with the house, but it's, if you're just an American coming over there trying to play this game, you can't play it because it's much more, I don't use a Byzantine because it sounds like maybe what it really is, but it's more convoluted than we're used to in the USA. Mm-hmm. And it takes longer. And it's hard to know when it's over. And bluffing is part of it. Doesn't mean you're not willing to supply the goods for the price you put on it. You are. But you know they're not going to buy it. Sure, they'd like to buy it for the lower price you offer. But when is it over is the real game. But it's certainly a bluffing game.
Okay. Yes, it is.
I don't equate bluffing with lying because in the situation that you described and that you described, everybody knows what's going on. They don't know what's going on in your mind, but they know the game and they're playing the game.
It's transparent.
Which is different than out and out lying. I make a sharp distinction between the two. Getting back to something I said earlier, the problem that I have with Carr is that, the article, the notion, is that the rules themselves are not clearly understood.
Can you give this to us?
Well, I think within each universe, they have rules.
Yeah.
And at the fault line, you have a blended set of rules that permits them to deal with one another in a way that continues a relationship because they are independent.
All right. So this is Jeff's bridge.
right? But what are these two universes for you?
And one is the structured universe of the court.
Okay. All right. So you're going to keep that, right?
I think so. And then the structured universe, the unstructured universe of the street, right. But which, as Jen said, has its own rules, which turn on sort of fundamental Confucian values.
Okay. Yeah. So all right. So that's really where I wanted to get. So and this to your use of the term value. So what are the values? So for Sydney's purposes, I think. When you say, so we've got the rules, but they're not very clear, we need to interpret them. I think that both Paul and, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name earlier, and Diane are saying the means by which we interpret these rules successfully and in unison is what you're calling now the Confucian values, which are, I think, our three analects give us. These. I think that, so you take these rules, which are the rules of the game, which include bluffing, asking high, bidding low, and coming to an agreement, but incorporating these values, you come up to a solution where the rules are applied even to your satisfaction. Yeah.
To my understanding, below the line, we have what I might call a dynamic evolutionary adventure of thoughts and consciousness. Below the line.
Yeah.
Beyond space-time context.
Yeah.
Above the line is a contextualization of that to give some sense and semblance of stability
yeah.
in a particular environment. Both are deeply connected.
Well, now, do you accept the notion that ethics plays out at the intersection of these
two? Sure.
Okay. Great. Well, then I think we're all in agreement.
Lee,
yeah.
I'd like to ask a question of all the business people here. It seems to me I was in the world of medicine and surgery, and I would like to believe that our world does not include bluffing. And I think you'd like to at least believe that also. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But let's leave that aside for a moment, and let me ask you the following. If it seems to me, Lee, and all of you are concerned with the world outside of business where we funnel these practices. And then there's the world that was described in the bluffing business. And it seems to me that you all would agree, as I'm listening to you, that if it's relatively okay to be in this business world of bluffing as long as, as Sydney said, everybody knows the rules. Now, what I'd like to ask Andy and all of you is whether you've ever been confronted with someone who enters your world but is unaware of your rules and how you handle that person, which then throws right in your face a problem of ethics. Because it may not be, or maybe it is and I'm naive, but I can could perhaps think up a situation in which a business person all of a sudden is confronting someone, whether everybody's in the West or somebody comes from the East and somebody from the West, where they don't know your rules. And what will you do then?
Could I just complicate this for a second? And that is that if you accept Carr's argument that there is a set of rules that are called the rules of the game for business, right? He would almost certainly argue, and I think many of us in this room would argue, the same thing applies to medicine, and the same thing applies to law. That is that as a professional, you have a set of standards that applies specifically to physicians, people occupied with the delivery of medical assistance of some kind. And the same thing would be true of the law. So the American lawyers have the American Bar Association, you have the American Medical Association, right? Organizations that are meant to ensure the sanctity of the rules that you have articulated for people who practice what you practice. I'm not sure that that's significantly different from what Carr is talking about in his discussion of business. So, you're in the mix. Two. You're in the mix too. So then you can still ask the question.
Whether
what do you do?
My world doesn't understand.
Right. What do you do?
I have a great little anecdote, which is quite interesting. I mean, how many here believe that the Angolan government is corrupt?
The Angolan government.
Yeah. Okay. Trust me, it's one of the most corrupt governments. We've just gone back to Angola. We went back middle of last year. Actually, yeah, May last year. And on the very point of rules and what's acceptable or not, we had to spend 6 years sitting across a table from Angolan government representatives describing why we couldn't play by their rules. And their rules were brown paper envelopes, signing bonuses, etc., etc., etc. And why was that? It was economic. If we played by those rules and we were investing over a 50-year period, what was going to happen when they left? We were going to ask to pay more brown paper envelopes, and so on and so forth, and we wouldn't have an economically sustainable business. And so we had a long 6-year debate about, are you prepared to let us in because we want to invest for 50 years, but if we do that, we need the kind of security, the kind of stability in the rights that we will gain that we can actually operate in this country for 50 years. And at the end of the day, they agreed, and we're now there, and actually, so far, we have not touched the brown paper envelope. We haven't even been asked for it.
How does that address the innocence piece of David's scenario?
Well, I think there were two totally different sets of rules.
Right, okay, but so that's... So
and it's a question of how you discuss it.
Neither side was naive.
I hate what you're saying.
Right.
I can't...
Sorry.
I'll leave my Confucius world and go to my trading world, and I would say if you're not forced into the game, you're in the game. If you're not forced into the game... And you think if you show up in Japan and don't speak the language, and you build a car and you put the steering wheel on the left side, and you try to sell the cars over there, as Chrysler did, and you realize a year later everyone's driving on the right side of the road, you're in the game. No one forced Chrysler to go over there, and they lost and they went home. So I would say that if you show up to play in the game,
it's your problem.
No one forced you in the game. You are in the game, my rules, and I can win fairly by doing something that I've already been doing there.
Okay, Melanie, last comment.
Oh, I don't want that responsibility. I think one of the things that Carr concludes with is put yourself in a strong position. And I know having been a world banker going to countries where practices were very similar to what you just described, that the world that I had the strength, I had the money on my side, and they had to adhere to my rules, and I wouldn't be able to do my job any other way, and so they had to conform. And being strong forces the other side to conform.
I think being
strong. But they learned your rules.
Sorry?
But you made them aware of your rules, as Jonathan obviously did.
Yeah. And I think the other piece, you could fairly respond to your challenge by saying these five characteristics. So courtesy, tolerance, good faith, diligence, and generosity. If I exercise them towards you as a naïf in the business world, at some level, you will be ushered into my world with an element of respect and protection that does look ethical. Right?
That's really important. If you don't press your advantage to the ultimate, because you're going to need this person again, or this entity again, someplace. If he remembers that you treated him with fairness and integrity and all those good things, you've got a chance to survive with him.
Right.
The next time you meet him, he's going to have his own knowledge and his own armies.
Oh, yeah.
And the guy that presses the ultimate advantage is going to be the loser next time around.
But isn't there the old cops and robbers or TV mysteries and whatever, where the rookie cop comes in and he has to learn that the rules of the road are that you take some money here and there for the right people to continue to do supposedly the right thing, or it's a kind of maturation to know what the environment is that you're working in.
Right.
And I think it's a matter of when someone who's a naif, is that the right? I see a knife.
Knife.
It depends on the person who's doing the explanation or the teaching to either say this is the way it is and that's how it has to be, or to try to sugarcoat it at the beginning to give you a sense of what it is and say, yeah, you know, I never thought that you have to kind of stretch that a little. And then so the next time, well, you know, you might stretch that a little. And maybe that's how you get them into the flow of what the game is.
All right, so Barry has just opened Pandora's box, right? And we are already 7 minutes over. So let me just say briefly, you're arguing for situational ethics, really. You know, that this is these are the rules of the game in this particular game, right? And so you should learn how to play it. Of course, Jonathan's example was, I'm not going to play by those rules because I think there's a different set that is actually universal. And I regret that we didn't have a chance to see the scene from High Noon, because what that says really is the same standards apply, you know, in the Wild West and in the Wild East. And that's a universal. I don't know that that's the answer, Barry. I do know that we've got two different positions here. And, you know, if you, in having read Is Business Bluffing Ethical and Confucius, can say there actually is a bridgeable space here, you know, that you can put the street and the court together, then you're okay. And I think for most of us, you know, that gap that I talked about at the beginning between compliance and ethical behavior lies in this bridge. That's all for today. I'm sorry, but thank you for your time.